and welcome to The Sound of Economics, the podcast from Bruegel, the Brussels-based economic think tank. I'm your host, Rebecca Christie. I'm joined today by Christoph Kaufmann from Frankfurt, who is a senior economist at the European Central Bank and Bruegel's own Stavros Zenios. We are going to talk about one of the most interesting academic papers I can remember reading, which is about disaster risk in euro area bond markets. Essentially, the idea that when something goes catastrophically wrong with the euro, like the risk that a country might leave it, investment funds behave differently from other investors. And this has some real implications. So, Christoph, tell us about your work. Why did you choose to study this and what did you find?
Yeah, first of all, many thanks for having me, Rebecca. It's really great to be here today with both you and Stavros. And before I get started on talking about the paper, let me very briefly emphasize that in this talk today, in this conversation, I'm presenting my own views, and this is not necessarily the views of the whole ECB. Having said that, so thanks for giving this introduction. So indeed, what this paper is about is the behavior of investors during stress situations on euro area sovereign bond markets. And these stress situations, or as we call them in the paper, as you already said, like euro disaster risk episodes, you can understand as situations where you have a rapid rise in interest rate spreads of different euro area countries. And then we ask, what do different investors do in such a situation and why? So basically, who is stabilizing markets and like who is causing the stress or who is amplifying it? And indeed, as you already alluded to, we find a very peculiar and specific response of the investment fund sector, that they are the only ones who are actually selling and the other investor types are not. And before going into more of the details of that, I'd like to set a bit the scene and tell you a bit about who is actually holding sovereign debt in the euro area. So what's the investor base or the holder structure, as we also like to say, to make clear about what type of investors we're actually talking. And so what we have, and I'm sure you know all of these agents, is of course banks and insurance corporations and pension funds. Then we have the investment funds, which are so much in the focus today, the households, and of course also a large chunk of international or global investors. And the exact holder structure is, of course, very, very different for individual countries. But what we can say is that banks and insurers are the by far largest holders. So they hold something like 20% each. And then the investment funds tend to hold something between 10% up to, in some countries, even 25%. So they are a very important holder sector. And then when it comes to other sectors, it depends much more on the country. So, for example, in countries like Germany or France, international foreign investors, so outside the euro area, they're very important. In countries like Italy, the domestic households are very important, stuff like that. And so why am I telling you this? Because this decomposition, the structure of the investor base matters a lot, actually, because in crisis situations, their behavior is very different. And this means when investors adjust their portfolios, for example, when the investment funds sell government bonds during a crisis situation, this also affects, of course, sovereign bond prices and ultimately can also then affect the ability of the governments to refinance themselves in a cheap way, at least. And then there's the question, why the specific focus on the investment funds today? So what makes them so special, and where does this finding come from that we alluded already, that they seem to be the main seller in such a crisis situation? The reason why it's good and important to look at this sector is, I think there's three important aspects. First of all, the sector has grown so much over the last 20 years. And so by now, it's the largest component of what we also call the non-bank financial intermediation space, or NBFI in short. In the past, this is also has also been called the shadow banking space. Then the second, it's relatively loosely regulated, in particular compared to banks or insurers. And third, and I think this is probably very important to raise here, is they can be quite prone to runs from investors. So think of a situation like March 2020, for example, no? So a situation where the investors into the funds can withdraw their money quickly and at very short notice, forcing the funds, the asset managers who are managing this fund, to sell the underlying assets. This is something that we've seen by now many times, and which can make this sector quite vulnerable. And I think this is the reason why we looked so deeply into this combination of these relatively loosely regulated, sometimes quite flighty entities on a very important segment of financial markets, namely the sovereign debt market. So this is basically the reason why we were looking into this combination. And now moving a bit deeper into the analysis itself and giving you kind of the high level points from that is, so first of all, when thinking about stress on sovereign bond markets, we need a way to identify that. And what we do there is we basically take credit default swaps and look at what is happening on events on days with the largest spikes. So when there's rapid surges in these CDS measures. And then we have luckily access to an extremely detailed news archive with intraday information where we can check what exactly was actually happening on those dates when there are these really large spikes. And this is an example from 2007 up to quite recently and end of 2023, actually. And when doing this, we found that the triggers for the stress situations, the largest stress situations, oftentimes revolve around unexpected political events. So this can be elections, snap elections in particular, political leader resignations, or for example, in the context of the euro crisis, also disagreements between national governments and international institutions and so on. And also to get a bit an idea, okay, what else is happening actually economically on the situations, we find that financial conditions deteriorate quite a bit. Market volatility is going up, the euro exchange rate devaluates, and so on. And having established that, we then use extremely granular information where we exactly know which investors holding which bond, and then we can identify who is actually behaving in which way when there's such a stress situation. And from this analysis comes out that the investment funds sell in particular the debt of countries that are in, let's say, financial troubles, under market pressure. They sell these debt persistently, a term that has also been used to describe these countries in the past. The geographical term is, of course, this euro area periphery. So think of countries like Italy, Greece, Cyprus, Spain, Portugal, and so on. Maybe a quick digression here that is important is over this long time span, these countries have, of course, changed quite a bit, and a lot of countries have made quite some efforts to improve and become less vulnerable. But by and large, this is the kind of countries we want to think about. And then in a second step, we compare the behavior of the investment funds to basically all other investors on euro area debt markets. So we have the whole universe available. And there we then see it's actually only the investment funds at home and abroad who are selling. And instead, we see that the banks step in the short term. So they pick up the debt. So here, maybe also one aspect to flag is the important or this notorious bank sovereign nexus, doom loop, and so on, of course. And then more when you track this over time, you see the banks not necessarily always stick to all those debt that they picked up in the short term in the crisis situation, but they actually hand it then over to insurance corporations and households more in the medium term. And what is also important here to highlight is that it's oftentimes the domestic investors who are picking up the debt. So it would be Italian insurers picking up Italian debt.
Super interesting. Can you just tell us briefly the names of your co-authors? And for listeners who want, we will also have a link to the whole paper in the show notes.
Oh, yes. That's my pleasure, of course. This is joint work with three colleagues of mine from the ECB. This is Yorgos Yorgadis, Pablo Anaya, and Katarina Zera.
Stavros, you have done so much work at Bruegel and elsewhere on debt sustainability, which is broadly speaking the idea that a country that borrows money is able to pay it back or at least keep up with the interest payments and continue to have access to financial markets for future needs. So how does this work fit in that universe and what do you make of it?
I found this very fascinating work in typical kind of ECB fashion, a very rich database, and they dig very deeply to understand several economic mechanisms, some of which have been known in other contexts, but it's still very nice to put everything together. In this context of the sovereign doom loop with something else, Christoph mentioned the sovereign bank doom loop. I saw in the paper they also mentioned the sovereign insurance doom loop, which I think was the first time I've seen this reference. Very interesting. But I think this paper is showing that a sovereign doom loop exists with many other aspects of the financial markets, and in this case, with investors. Like investors flee a sovereign that's in trouble, and this makes the trouble of the sovereign worse and makes investors flee even more. So In this sense, it was very interesting understanding of some of the mechanisms. I also got another reading of this paper. It's not so much, I mean, you mentioned disaster risk and Christoph emphasized it. But I think I see something else here, that this adverse reaction is happening before you really come to a disaster, is when things are getting increasingly more stressful, you start seeing these behaviors, which eventually, of course, they may lead to a disaster, which brings me to some of my own work and the work by others and some colleagues at Bruegel on the desustainability issue. Desustainability, and the way I have been developing it with some of my co-authors, is in the context of stochastic processes, like things fluctuate. It's not just a projection you make in the future and see what you clearly described, the ability of the government to pay at least the interest. It's a realization that in a stochastic context, there are correlations. One thing drives another, and all these things together can interact with debt. And we have seen in the past, a recent working paper we had at Bruegel is to show that political risk, political uncertainty, is an important determinant of debt sustainability. It's affecting interest rates. We have documented this phenomenon, the effect of political uncertainty on sovereign refinancing rates. We have shown how it affects the sovereign debt sustainability. We are now doing some work to look at the US sovereign debt after the big, beautiful bill. You will see it shortly at Bruegel. And the paper by ECB is explaining one of the mechanisms through which political risk propagates into sovereign debt sustainability issue, namely the fact that Christoph pointed out that investors react to unexpected political shocks. So there are many layers in this paper that I found very interesting. And one question I have, maybe Christoph can elaborate on this or can discuss it later. But when you look at investors, you pointed out it's partly foreign investors and some are local investors. To what extent is the foreign investors that drive the performance you have observed? And local home investors, local investors are more patient with their governments, because this will bring another dimension to the analysis. Is it really the investment funds that is the problem, or is the driver of the loop, or is it the foreigners, the non-domestic?
Christoph, you touched on this at the beginning and would love to hear a little more elaboration. How does the doom loop work in these different contexts?
Thanks so much for the comments and the questions, Stavros. So I think indeed these works speak very well to each other, because indeed in this paper we highlight this these political risks indeed as a very important trigger. And yeah, maybe let me highlight that indeed, compared to this bank doom loop that has been out there for years, of course, and is very well noted, when people were talking about it, they were always wondering, okay, what's the reason that the banks are actually stepping in? And here we basically turned this around. Okay, what's actually the reason that people run away? So how is that? And going more deeply into that. Coming back to your question, like, who is it actually? Is it more the foreigners, or who is it behind? So we can indeed separate investment funds that are domiciled directly in the euro area, and or whether they are domiciled outside, be it in the US, in the UK, somewhere else in the world. And we would indeed find that investment funds domiciled outside the euro area, they would be more flighty. So they would add much more to this procyclicality. And there can, of course, be several reasons or theories why this is the case. One is, of course, that investors and also the asset managers, when they are far more away from the euro area, may have less expertise about that. And therefore, they get sensitive and nervous more quickly. That's for sure one explanation.
In the next section of the podcast, I'd like to talk a little more about the interaction between political risk and other types of economic fundamentals. Stavros, you were just talking about how political uncertainty can contribute to this every bit as much as other more traditional factors like inflation and unemployment and things that bond investors usually look at. Bruegel has done some work about pro-European or anti-European governments, particularly in Italy. I remember a paper showing that bond investors really paid attention to that as a sign of where things are going. Christoph, do you think we've reached the point where politics is an economic fundamental, or does it work alongside them?
Excellent question, I would say. What we learned from this analysis here is that's of first order importance, I think, for financial markets. And they watch these political developments and what politicians say very closely. And when I said where we were looking into these intraday news archives, you could really see in case of, let's say, Eurosceptical mentionings of political parties, you could sometimes see immediate spikes and strong and persistent spikes in the interest rates for those countries. And this, of course, then has immediate ramifications and increasing the financing costs for those countries. So maybe if you allow one more sentence on this. So this goes also, I think, a bit in this direction of, what sometimes is also called the bond vigilantes, no? So those types of investors who put governments under a lot of scrutiny and, punish debtors very quickly by moving away. And I think our analysis here would basically say that those bond vigilantes are most likely to be found mainly among the investment funds and also the underlying investors, of course.
What do you think, Stavros?
I mean, it's a very deep question with many facets, Rebecca. We could have several podcasts on this. Political risk, is, first of all, is a multifaceted concept. Is it the uncertainty surrounding certain policies by the government that's having an effect? Is it government instability per se? We had seen, for example, in the case of the Greek crisis, we had seen governments coming and going, but the policy was basically staying the same. You remember the famous referendum of the Greek government to throw away the MOU, but eventually they implemented it. So evidence, and there's lots of research from academics studying the political risk on the markets. It has been documented that political risk is having an effect everywhere in stocks, bonds, in currencies. And it's having effect in both its policy implications, like policies changing, and also in the government stability dimension. And some of the work we have done, we have shown that is both a cash flow effect, the numerator, like if a government implements policies that are not good for growth, it affects the numerator. But at the same time, if the government creates uncertainty, for example, the current U.S. administration on the tariffs, of the tariffs, is not so much if tariffs have an adverse effect on the economy, it's also the question of what exactly is going on. So that's a discount rate effect. So political risk is affecting both of these dimensions, and we have seen it becoming increasingly more significant in the markets. We have also, it was kind of a surprising, some of recent research that we've done, but it has been vetted very carefully and got published, that political risk is not just local, as we used to think. There is a global systematic component to political risk. Countries are influencing each other in a kind of network effects. It's not just the United States affecting the rest of the world, which of course it is true, but there is aggregate fluctuations in the context of what Acemoglu and his colleagues have been talking about. And this has been very strongly documented in empirical data that political risk has a strong systematic component which affects the markets globally and across different asset classes, not just government bonds, but also, as I said, the equities market and the currencies.
Christoph, can you walk us through monetary union and the particular characteristics of the euro area that make this so crucial here? What I wanted to ask about was Stavros was just talking about the global context for these interactions between politics and economics and markets. And what we've seen over the last couple of decades is that the euro area, because it's all of these countries together and because they have a common monetary policy for countries that have sometimes very different conditions on the ground, these effects play a different role than they do for countries that are more self-contained. And so I was hoping if you could walk us through some of the considerations for people thinking about the euro area.
Indeed, conducting these independent fiscal policies in a monetary union is, of course, very different to when you have your own monetary policy and your own central bank and your full autonomy about over your exchange rate. And I think we had a lot of discussions on this already in the context of the euro crisis some years ago. I think what I find here also in this context of these political risk in particular is that there can be so strong spillovers, no? And when you're in a monetary union, your own behavior is not only affecting yourself and your own economy, but you may have very clear direct ramifications also on your fellow countries in the union. So, for example, what we see is that when there's stress in one country, for example, due to political uncertainty, this also quickly has negative effects on the yields and in this sense also the refinancing costs of other countries. Maybe also in another sense, not only on the political risk, but also when it comes to additional spending. I think a very nice, almost textbook-like example was when the German government earlier this year was announcing this big spending package, which led to an immediate increase not only in the German interest rate, but actually also to an immediate increase also in the interest rates of the other countries. So spreads were not moving, but the whole level was rising for everyone. And this is something very peculiar to a monetary union. And of course, some of this debt finance spending will benefit all, but everybody else also has then to cover the costs of this to some extent.
Thanks for that. We're now 10 years after the last gasp of Greece's turmoils in terms of negotiating packages with the euro area. And we have a generation of policymakers who are coming up now who didn't come up during the crisis at the same time that we see spreads converging sometimes in response to global trends the way they did before the crisis. So for me anyway, I find myself really wanting to go back to basics and thinking about how does this work? What are the relationships? Another reason why I find this work so fascinating. Stavros, what are some lessons that you think are particularly worth keeping in mind given the current policy environment?
I think to make the point that you just raised that people keep forgetting is when things are good, all the countries in the union are rising or falling together. When there is a stressful situation, relative weaknesses start becoming important. So it's important, I think, for every country to make sure they do not have large weaknesses relative to the rest and also don't become complacent. That the fact that you are in the union and good times help everybody. If your economy has strains, the moment there is a little bit of fluctuation, I mean, snap elections in France or a failing coalition in Germany, is going to affect everybody. So that's I think one lesson to be taken out of this. Now there is also the usual debate, like in favor of a union or in favor of more independence. The fact that there are spillovers, it doesn't answer the question, would you be better off if you had your own freedom, to devalue your own currency or to build up inflation? Well, there are politicians, especially populists and the general public, have to be very cautious before they draw inferences that, yes, there are some price to pay for being in a union. Things are most likely going to be much more volatile if you're on your own. The problems are not going to go away. So having the potential support from a bigger, being part of a bigger boat, we will never resolve this issue because we are never going to have an experiment, break things up and put them back together again to see how it works. But it's very hard to see that smaller entities with more degrees of freedom will be less volatile. I think it's important to understand the weaknesses and make sure you don't fall victim to them. But there's also another issue that I find very interesting and positive for the union that I have not seen being picked up a lot. I think colleagues at Bruegel mention it, but it does not seem to be very, very popular. And I'm not sure if Christophe would be willing to wait in this. But is the issue that when you have this global political uncertainty, especially in the United States these days, there is a heightened need for a safe asset. Who is going to provide it? Potentially the union, being this collection of multiple countries and a huge economy, they could potentially provide this safe asset. But it cannot be a safe asset unless it's really a union asset, which brings us to a different dimension. So there is something positive for the union that like it happened with the common debt for the next generation EU. That could be considered a safe asset, but these are small and not perpetual for investors to look into them. So I think there is an issue for investors not to be a source of a doom loop, that they should have access to an asset that's considered safe. And if your asset is considered safe, that aspect is going away. We've seen it a little bit with the banking crisis when it was assumed that sovereign debt is safe from the banker's point of view. Banks in some countries, mine included, and of course Greece, loaded very heavily on this debt. And when it was realized that it was not a safe asset, we had that banking crisis precipitated. But there is an opportunity for the union here to be considered. This global political risk affecting the markets adversely, the union seems to be a much more stable environment overall. Could it provide the safe asset that globally is needed today?
Before we get into the policy forward-looking implications of this, I do want to just come back to something in the paper. Christoph, talk to us a bit about the core countries. We've been talking just now about how in the periphery, countries are responsive to contagion, to sort of cyclical trends. But the other thing that your paper finds is that when the periphery runs into trouble, it doesn't necessarily translate into increased demand for the core euro countries. Does that make them more insulated to this policy and maybe more indifferent to it, or is that its own source of concern that there isn't a shift within the euro area, that instead there's a shift within sectors or around the world?
Yes, indeed. I think it's actually the latter. So, because if this was just a rotation within investors' euro exposure, they would say, okay, let's get out of country A and instead invest in country B. But this is not what we're seeing. Instead, we are really seeing, okay, the investors seem to withdraw their euro positions on average in this analysis. So they would instead rather go into something else, be it US treasuries or something else. So in this sense, this is also, I mean, even though the core countries may not be negatively affected immediately, but indirectly from this flight out of the euro and the resulting euro devaluation, they are also, of course, affected from that, yes.
Davos.
Yes, I mean, this relates to an issue. We had written a paper on neglected risk in the Eurozone, which had to do with the debt increase we had seen for a while. And the question is, was this debt increase creating risks? And the answer is yes, you can show that. And was that heightened risk neglected by the investors, was not priced until the crash came. And there we found very interesting that it was not only for the periphery countries that had this neglected risk phenomenon, it was also for the core countries. Of course, it was not as strong, but the phenomenon was there. So some of the risk, what I hear Christoph saying and the way I would interpret their paper, the risk they identified is common for all the countries, but of course the periphery countries or the weaker countries, the more strained public finance are affected more. It would be interesting, and maybe Christoph, his team has done it and he can tell us, it would be interesting to see if there is also some of the internal fragmentation. Like while you see investors fleeing both periphery and central countries, do you also see some shift from periphery to central?
Just to clarify exactly on this, so we do not see a flight from like the core countries, but we just do not see that investors would increase their exposure towards them. So they leave it quite unchanged. Yeah. So they would move out of periphery very clearly, but you wouldn't find a rotation within the euro towards the core. but rather they're kind of ignored, so to speak.
Okay, so it does not increase fragmentation internally, although the core countries do not suffer so much.
Well, it still does, no? But not on both sides.
It seems to me what you're saying is that if people look at fragmentation in the periphery and trends in the periphery and use that to move out of the euro entirely, that then sort of dilutes the underpinning of the whole enterprise. So it does have implications for the core countries.
Exactly. That's what I tried to say earlier. Because from this flight out of the whole currency area overall, this also has a negative effect and a depreciating effect on the currency. And in this way, it affects everyone.
But also I see this, Rebecca, I see something positive in this, if I may say so, that something that affects all of us negatively, it makes all of us trying to work together to solve it. If it was creating more fragmentation, I mean, if Greece's problem was to the benefit of Germany, why would anybody try to solve it, right? But if the problem in country, a big problem in country A becomes a small problem in country B, then everybody has an incentive to try to address it.
Yes, we're in this together, no?
Exactly. So I see something positive as a European, maybe as a nationalist. I may not see it that way, but as a European, I see something positive in this.
And that is a great lead-in to the last section of our podcast, where we will talk about policy implications of all of this work. Christoph, do you have any observations about fiscal or regulatory or other sorts of policy things that people should think about?
Yes, absolutely. I think first and foremost, this speaks to the fiscal side. So I think governments should be very well aware who are their investors. And I think usually they know this also very well, because the exact composition can matter a lot what is happening in a crisis situation. And I think the wider implication of this is also that this flighty behavior of the investment funds, this pro-cyclicality in the markets, the flip side of this is that this can also have quite a disciplining effect on fiscal policies. An example for this outside the euro area is probably the mini budget crisis in the UK, right? Where we had, after this announcement of a fiscal policy which was considered as fiscally unsustainable, we had a massive reaction of financial markets, which led also to a withdrawal of these proposals. So I think this is something very important to keep in mind, this disciplining effect. And then on the other hand, this leads over to maybe regulatory aspects or the investment funds. And how should we think about the investment funds here in this context? Should we think about them as the bad culprits who are bringing instability to markets or not? And I think on the one hand, of course, we probably need to regulate this whole non-bank financial intermediation space much more and make it more resilient to situations like this, so that there's not like something like a forced selling or outflows from the investment fund sector directly leads to widespread asset price deterioration and so on. But at the same time, some disciplining effects you also want to probably keep in the system. And I think that's a fine balance we want to strike. And maybe also allow me to say one more thing on this. So I think it's important to highlight this, that this is indeed not only destabilizing. So because this sector, of course, has very important positive aspects, no? And it, for example, when it comes to capital market integration in Europe, there's a clear benefit of this large sector. And so on.
I consider myself a risk management scholar. So what I see in these situations, which I find very, very interesting and very pleasant as a scholar, maybe not as in policymaking, is that we should be aware of the risks we have not thought about. Now this very interesting paper by ECB has documented the adverse effect of investors on sovereign debt. This is kind of an interesting new type of risk that has been documented. So we should be, government should be aware of potential risks that they have not thought about. Could someone else in these, you know, multiple players in the economy react in a way that adversely affects the government if the government does something wrong, if the government gets into trouble? Now, in such situations, I think we have to very carefully decide, do you want to regulate the other people's behavior, the other players' behavior, or do you want to regulate our own behavior? Here, I would be a little bit skeptical. I mean, we should monitor very carefully what investors do. But our job as governments is to make sure we provide good investment opportunities for investors to come in. Otherwise, we are pro-free market as a European Union, and it's unavoidable. If we do something bad, some actors are going to get out. And I think the actors you cannot really control if you want to be a free market economy is the investors. Investors are going to look for the best opportunities, and it's important for us, our governments, in this case, to provide policies and follow politics that are attractive from the point of view of the international investor. I think this is an important policy lesson I would learn for this in a positive way. The markets can discipline you. Well, let's be disciplined. I mean, the term is discipline, not punishing, right?
I really appreciate your bringing that up because the thing that comes up in European policy circles sometimes is confusing who's doing the action in market discipline. Is it something that policies impose? Oh, we're going to hang you out to dry and do some market discipline to you? Or is it, as you both are saying, that the markets themselves will, through their pricing, introduce a consideration that might have a disciplining effect? And I think remembering that the markets are independent actors here is really helpful.
Maybe to add one more thing to that, I think what is important to keep in mind when we talk about the investment fund, so who's actually behind? I mean, it's all of us, no? We who are investing into an ETF and so on, and the asset managers who are then divesting, they are acting on our behalf and in our best interest, no? So I wouldn't necessarily see all of their behavior as purely pro-cyclical and wrong. Only when it comes to a situation when this pro-cyclicality becomes so strong that it's becoming systemic, so that it's a financial stability risk, and then we need to intervene. And if this is the case, maybe also stronger regulations are needed, of course. And this is something where also the ECB has, for many years now advocated to strengthen the resilience of the sector.
Do you have any thoughts on safe asset and how that might interact with these national bond market trends?
It's a good point. No, and this is also something, this whole safe asset debate that came up now more recently again, also in these discussions about a stronger international role of the euro, and that one precondition for this could be to have more euro-denominated safe assets. And yeah, it's not an easy topic. There's different ways to achieve that, no? I mean, one obvious way to achieve that is also if we say, okay, so far there's from among the large countries, there's only Germany that is really, or by now, providing a safe asset anymore. One way is also, of course, that the other countries, do fiscal reforms and make their bonds a safe asset again. That's one way. That's not easy at all. It has a lot of implications. Then I think there's probably also some room for other ways to create a safe asset at the union level. And I think also from ECB board members, they every now and then utter opinions in these directions and proposals. Like, for example, when there's joint spending at the union level, it could also be natural to also finance this with a joint safe asset. The question is, of course, then do you implement this institutionally? Is this large enough to be attractive long enough for international investors? I think, Stavros, you mentioned earlier also that within Next Generation EU package, this was something in this direction, but it's also small and it's becoming smaller again.
That's a whole nother podcast about whether a safe asset has to be a market benchmark or if it's enough for it just to be relatively risk-free and have a top credit rating.
Exactly.
But you recognize, I mean, I think that the need for this is recognized. It is a difficult problem, as Christoph says, so we cannot resolve it today, and maybe several podcasts will not resolve it. But I think there is a recognition that this is an important issue to be addressed. It's not a pie in the sky issue. So.
Yeah, I think we would probably need to discuss in great detail the whole fiscal architecture of the euro area for that, right? So how to engineer this in the best way to align incentives and so on. And I would agree. That's a whole series of podcasts. It's a fascinating topic.
You're welcome back anytime. But we're coming to the end of our time today. So I guess I would ask each of you to offer a few thoughts specifically on disasters and financial stability. I think it's worth reminding people what is a disaster and how do we avoid having them going forward. Davros, you want to go?
What I'm learning from this conversation, great to meet you, Christoph, and thank you, Rebecca, is not so much the disaster that things becoming really bad, like the Greek sovereign debt crisis, but on the way to the disaster, pressures are building up, and we have to be aware of them. And at some point, the weaker countries are going to feel the heat, are going to see their spreads increasing, and they are going to see certain kind of investors getting away and precipitating an adverse loop. So this is the one lesson I'm learning from this. Understand where the weaknesses are, try to understand the potential risks that can make your weaknesses stand out. Investor behavior is one of them. It's a very interesting paper. It has documented it. Political risk, both in its increasing uncertainty and reducing cash flows, is another important dimension. And risk management is about being aware of the risks you have not thought about. So thank you very much. This was lovely.
Yeah, hard to add to that. No, I fully agree with Stavros on these points. I think in general, policymakers need to spend a lot of time and effort to avoid that an actual disaster is taking place, and think of the global financial crisis. So something like this we need to avoid. And I think in case, for example, of the euro crisis instead, it was more the fear of an disaster happening, but not the materialization of it, no? Because the euro survived and in its complete form. But already this fear of that of a disaster looming can have self-reinforcing effects that can grow on its own. And I think we need to pay a lot of attention to this.
Thank you so much for that. We've been listening to Christoph Kaufmann, one of the co-authors of the new ECB working paper, Investment Funds and Euro Disaster Risk, joined by Bruegel's Stavros Xenios. We will link to the ECB paper and some of Stavros's debt sustainability work in the show notes, which you can find at our website, Bruegel.org, along with all the archives of this podcast and other kinds of interesting stuff. Thank you so much for listening. I'm your host, Rebecca Christie. You've been listening to The Sound of Economics from Bruegel. Thank you and see you next time.